The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Bonus Edition, November 13th, 2019. On Wednesday, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence held its first in a series of public hearings pursuant to its impeachment inquiry into President Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 election. Today, the committee heard testimony from George Kent, Deputy Assistant Secretary in the European and Eurasian Affairs Bureau at the State Department, and William Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine. While the witnesses had a compelling story to tell, there was some disagreement among members about both fact and process. So we cut out all the bickering, all the speechifying, and all the procedural maneuvering to bring you just the testimony that you need to hear. It's the Lawfare Podcast Bonus Edition, George Kent and Bill Taylor versus the committee with no bull.
I thank you both for your testimony, and I now recognize myself and Majority Counsel for 45 minutes of questions.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Taylor, I would like to begin by following up on something that you have disclosed today and you disclosed earlier to both majority and minority, but it is some new information for the committee. You said in your testimony that one of your staff was present with Ambassador Sondland on the day after the July 25th phone call. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And as your staff related the event to you, your staff member could overhear Mr. Sondland on the phone, could overhear the president on the phone with Mr. Sondland. Is that right?
That's correct.
The president must have been speaking loud enough on the phone. This was a cell phone, I take it?
It was a cell phone.
The president must have been speaking loud enough for your staff member to be able to overhear this?
It was.
And what your staff member could overhear was President Trump asking Ambassador Sondland about, quote, the investigations. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, I think you testified also that you had come to understand that the term investigations was a term that Ambassador Sondland, as well as Volker, used to mean matters related to the 2016 elections and to the investigations of Burisma and the Bidens. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
So your staff member overhears the president asking about the investigations, meaning Burisma and the Bidens in 2016. And Ambassador Sondland told President Trump that the Ukrainians were ready to move forward?
He did.
And I think you said that after the call, when your staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought of Ukraine, his response was that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden. Is that right?
And Burisma, yes, sir.
And I take it the import of that is he cares more about that than he does about Ukraine.
Yes, sir.
During your testimony, Ambassador Taylor, you also said that more Ukrainians would undoubtedly die without U.S. assistance. Why is that?
Mr. Chairman, the security assistance that we provide, it takes many forms. One of the components of that assistance is counter-battery radar. Another component are sniper weapons. These weapons and this assistance it allows the Ukrainian military to deter further incursions by the Russians against their own, against Ukrainian territory. If that further incursion, further aggression were to take place, more Ukrainians would die. So it is a deterrent effect that these weapons provide. It's also the ability, it gives the Ukrainians the ability to negotiate from a position of a little more strength when they negotiate an end to the war in Donbas, negotiating with the Russians. This also is a way that would reduce the number of Ukrainians who would die.
I take it if the provision of U.S. military assistance would save Ukrainian lives, that any delay in that assistance may also cost Ukrainian lives. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, of course, it's hard to draw any direct lines between any particular element of security assistance and any particular death on the battlefield. But it is certainly true that that assistance had enabled Ukrainian armed forces to be effective and deter and to be able to take countermeasures to the attacks that the Russians had.
And I think you said that a Ukrainian soldier lost their life while you were visiting Donbas.
We keep very careful track of the casualties, and I noticed on the next day the information that we got that one was killed, four soldiers were wounded on that day.
And indeed, Ukrainians lose their lives every week.
Every week.
I think you also testified that Russia was watching closely to gauge the level of American support for the Ukrainian government. Why is that significant?
This is significant, Mr. Chairman, because the Ukrainians, in particular under this new administration, are eager to end this war, and they are eager to end it in a way that the Russians leave their territory. These negotiations, like all negotiations, are difficult. Ukrainians would like to be able to negotiate from a position of strength, or at least more strength than they now have. Part of that strength, part of the ability of the Ukrainians to negotiate against the Russians, with the Russians, for an end to the war in Donbas, depends on the United States and other international support. If we withdraw or suspend or threaten to withdraw our security assistance, that's a message to the Ukrainians, but it's at least as important, as your question indicates, Mr. Chairman, to the Russians, who are looking for any sign of weakness or any sign that we are withdrawing our support for Ukraine.
And so when the Ukrainians learned of the suspension of the military aid, either privately or when others learned publicly, the Russians would be learning also. And they would take that as a lack of robust U.S. support for Ukraine. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
And that would weaken Ukraine in negotiating an end to the war in Donbas.
It would.
People watching, I'm sure, are interested in how military assistance and diplomatic support for Ukraine affects Ukraine, but even more so interested in how does this affect our national security? Now, I think you said that if we believe in a principle of sovereignty of nations where countries get to determine their own economic, political, and security alliances, we have to support Ukraine in its fight, that the kind of aggression we see by Russia can't stand. How is it important to American national security that we provide for a robust defense of Ukraine's sovereignty?
Mr. Chairman, as my colleague, Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent, described, we have a national security policy, a national defense policy that identifies Russia and China as adversaries. The Russians are violating all of the rules, treaties, understandings that they committed to that actually kept the peace in Europe for nearly 70 years. Until they invaded Ukraine in 2014, they had abided by sovereignty of nations, of inviolability of borders. That rule of law, that order that kept the peace in Europe and allowed for prosperity as well as peace in Europe was violated by the Russians. And if we don't push back on that, on those violations, then that will continue. And that, Mr. Chairman, affects us. It affects the world that we live in, that our children will grow up in, and our grandchildren. This affects the kind of world that we want to see abroad. So that affects our national interest very directly. Ukraine is on the front line of that conflict.
I want to thank you both for your decades of service to the country, and I'll now recognize Mr. Goldman for questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador Taylor, on the heels of you discussing the importance of the security assistance to Ukraine, I want to go to the end of the timeline where you learned that that security assistance was conditioned on Ukraine announcing the investigations that the president wanted. And in particular, on September 9th of this year, you texted Ambassador Sondland and Volker, and the text message should be on the screen in front of you. And if you could read what you wrote.
As I said on the phone, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign.
What did you mean when you said you thought it was crazy?
Ms. Goldman, I meant that the important, because of the importance of security assistance that we had just described and had a conversation with the chairman, because that was so important, that security assistance was so important for Ukraine as well as our own national interest, to withhold that assistance for no good reason other than help with the political campaign made no sense. It was counterproductive to all of what we had been trying to do. It was illogical. It could not be explained. It was crazy.
When you say all of what we were trying to do, what do you mean by we?
I mean that the United States was trying to support Ukraine as a frontline state against Russian attack. And again, the whole notion of a rules-based order was being threatened by the Russians in Ukraine. So our security assistance was designed to support Ukraine. That's it. It was not just the United States. It was all of our allies.
When you reference help with a political campaign in this text message, what did you mean?
I meant that the investigation of Burisma and the Bidens was clearly identified by Mr. Giuliani in public for months. As a way to get information on the two Bidens.
And that investigation, at the very least, was mentioned by President Trump in the July 25th phone call with President Zelensky. Is that right?
As we now know, yes. On September 25th, that transcript was released.
Ambassador Taylor, in your decades of military service and diplomatic service representing the United States around the world, have you ever seen another example of foreign aid conditioned on the personal or political interests of the President of the United States?
No, Mr. Goldman, I've not.
Mr. Kent, that vital military assistance that was not the only thing that President Trump was withholding from Ukraine, what else was contingent on Ukraine initiating these investigations?
Well, as we've talked earlier today, the possibility of a White House meeting was being held contingent to an announcement.
How important to President Zelensky was a White House meeting?
New leaders, particularly countries that are trying to have good footing in the international arena, see a meeting with the U.S. president in the Oval Office at the White House as the ultimate sign of endorsement and support from the United States.
And President Zelensky was a relatively new president, is that right?
That's correct. He was elected on April 21st, and his government was formed after parliamentary elections in July.
Would a White House meeting for President Zelensky boost his legitimacy as a new president in Ukraine?
It would primarily boost his leverage to negotiate with Vladimir Putin about the Russian occupation of 7% of Ukrainian territory.
Mr. Ken, is pressuring Ukraine to conduct what I believe you've called political investigations a part of U.S. foreign policy to promote the rule of law in Ukraine and around the world?
It is not.
Is it in the national interest of the United States?
In my opinion, it is not.
Why not?
Because our policies, particularly in promoting the rule of law, are designed to help countries, and in Eastern Europe and Central Europe, that is overcoming the legacy of communism. In the communist system, in particular, the Prosecutor General Office was used to suppress and persecute citizens, not promote the rule of law. So in helping these countries reach their own aspirations to join the Western community of nations and live lives of dignity, helping them have the rule of law with strong institutions is the purpose of our policy.
So in other words, it is a purpose of our foreign policy to encourage foreign nations to refrain from conducting political investigations. Is that right?
Correct. And in fact, as a matter of policy, not of programming, we oftentimes raise our concerns, usually in private, with countries that we feel are engaged in selective political prosecution and persecution of their opponents.
Ambassador Taylor, now that we've established that you ultimately did understand that President Trump was withholding the security assistance and a White House meeting from Ukraine until they announced these investigations to benefit his reelection campaign, let's go back a little bit in time to when you first learned about this conditionality. And on September 1st, so a little more than a week before that text we just read, you sent another text to Ambassadors Sondland and Volker, which should be also be on the screen in front of you. And if you could read what you wrote to them.
Are we now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations?
And Ambassador Sondland responded, call me.
He did.
Now, what information had you learned that prompted you to write this text message?
I had learned that in Warsaw, after the meeting Vice President Pence had with President Zelensky, Ambassador Sondland had had meetings there and had described to Mr. Yermak, the assistant to President Zelensky, that the security assistance was also held pending announcement by President Zelensky in public of these investigations. Before that, I had only understood from Ambassador Sondland that the White House meeting was conditioned. And at this time, after I heard of this conversation, it struck me, it was clear to me that security assistance was also being held.
You said previously that you were alarmed to learn this. Why were you alarmed?
It's one thing to try to leverage a meeting in the White House. It's another thing, I thought, to leverage security assistance to a country at war, dependent on both the security assistance and the demonstration of support. It was much more alarming. The White House meeting was one thing. Security assistance was much more alarming.
Now, Ambassador Taylor, you, in your opening statement, you outlined a very detailed timeline. And in fact, we have a written copy here, and you included some phrases and words in quotations. Did you take notes of this conversation on September 1st with Ambassador Sondland?
I did.
And did you take notes related to most of the conversations, if not all of them, that you recited in your opening statement?
All of them, Mr. Goldman.
And what do those quotations that you include in your opening statement reflect?
They reflect my notes on the exact words that I heard on that call. So it was, if I put those in quotes, that meant that those are the words used on that phone call or in that conversation.
And did you review those notes before you drafted your opening statement and came here to testify?
I did.
Now, is that how, for example, you remember that Ambassador Sondland was on a train from Paris to London during a call in July?
That's correct.
And you are aware, I presume, that the State Department has not provided those notes to the committee. Is that right?
I am aware.
So we don't have the benefit of reviewing them to ask you these questions.
Correct. I understand that they may be coming sooner or later.
Well, we would welcome that. You also testified earlier, Ambassador Sondland, or Ambassador Taylor, that President Trump had delegated some matters overseeing Ukraine policy to Ambassador Sondland, who is a big inaugural supporter of President Trump, even though Ukraine is not in his domain of the European Union. Is that right?
Several participants in the meeting in the Oval Office with President Trump, with the delegation to the inauguration of President Zelensky, told me of that conversation, and it was at that meeting, as I understand it from several participants, that President Trump asked the participants to work with Mr. Giuliani on Ukraine policy.
Did you come to understand that Ambassador Sondland had a direct line of communication into President Trump?
I did.
And you testified, or rather in that text message, Ambassador Sondland says to call him after you wrote that. Did you, in fact, call him?
I did.
And what did he say to you?
He said that I was wrong about President Trump's intent, that there was no quid pro quo.
But did he say anything after that? Did he describe to you, I believe you said, I'll refresh your memory, that
thank you.
He mentioned something in your opening statement. You said that he said that everything, I believe, and you had that in quotes, was actually contingent on the initiation of these investigations. What did he mean by everything?
Ms. Goldman, what he meant by everything was the security assistance and the White House meeting.
And I believe you also testified that he said he had made a mistake in relaying a message to the Ukrainians. What was that mistake?
The mistake, he told me, was earlier he had told, presumably President Zelensky and Mr. Yermak, that what was necessary for the White House meeting was the pursuit of these investigations. And he said he recognized that that was a mistake. It was not just the White House meeting that was dependent on the investigations. He said it was now everything. It included the security assistance.
So it was not just the White House meeting, it was also the security assistance.
Yes, sir.
And so even though President Trump was saying repeatedly that there is no quid pro quo, Ambassador Sondland relayed to you that the facts of the matter were that the White House meeting and the security assistance were conditioned on the announcement of these investigations. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
Now, you reference a television interview and a desire for President Trump to put Zelensky in a public box, which you also have in quotes. Was that in your notes?
It was in my notes.
And what did you understand that to mean, to put Zelensky in a public box?
I understood that to mean that President Trump, through Ambassador Sondland, was asking for President Zelensky to very publicly commit to these investigations, that it was not sufficient to do this in private, that this needed to be a very public statement.
And did you understand why it was needed to be in public as opposed to a private confirmation?
I had no further information on that.
Now, during this time period in early September, did you come to understand that from your conversations with the Ukrainians or other individuals that Ukraine felt pressure to initiate these investigations because of the conditionality of the White House meeting and the security assistance?
Mr. Scobin, here's what I know. I got several questions. Other officials got several questions as well from Ukrainians asking about the security assistance. So what I know is the security assistance was very important to the Ukrainians. They had begun to hear from Ambassador Sondland that the security assistance was not going to come until the investigations were pursued. What I heard from the defense minister, what the senators, what Senator Johnson and Senator Murphy heard in their conversation with President Zelensky was the clear concern, the urgent concern that Ukrainians had about the security assistance.
Now, you also described a conversation that you had with Ambassador Sondland a week later on September 8th. And in that conversation, in your opening statement, you described how Ambassador Sondland used the term stalemate. What did you understand the concern about a stalemate to be?
Ambassador Sondland said that if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. He began that, again, by repeating, this is not a quid pro quo, but if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. And what I understood in that meeting, the meaning of stalemate was the security assistance would not come.
So even though he said the words, there were no quid pro quo, he then went on to say, but the security assistance will not come unless these investigations are done. Is that what you're saying?
My understanding, that's what was meant by stalemate.
You also described in your opening statement a discussion you had about President Trump being a businessman who wanted to have people pay up before signing the check. And what did you understand that to mean?
This was an explanation that Ambassador Sondland gave me about his understanding of President Trump's thought process. Ambassador Sondland is a businessman. President Trump's a businessman. He was explaining to me the relationship, the understanding that a businessman would have when he is about to sign a check. And by that, he clearly meant that President Trump was thinking about or had in front of him the possibility of providing security assistance to Ukraine. It was similar to writing a check to someone who you're about to send. He used that analogy very clearly to indicate that this would require something. If that person owed him something before he signed the check, he wanted to get whatever he was owed paid back to him. And Ambassador Volker used very similar language about a week later, which indicates to me that they had that conversation as well.
Did Ukraine owe anything to the United States?
Ms. Goldman, they didn't. They owed appreciation for the support, and they were getting support, and they appreciated that. But there was nothing owed to President Trump on that.
But you understood the upshot of this comment made by both Ambassador Sondland and Ambassador Volker to be that President Trump believed that Ukraine owed him something personally. Is that accurate?
It's hard to understand, but there was a feeling by President Trump that he—and this came out in the transcript— I'm sorry, this came out in the discussion with the inaugural delegation when they came back to have a conversation with President Trump on May 23rd, that he had a feeling of having been wronged by the Ukrainians. And so this was something that he thought they owed him to fix that wrong.
Right, but what he was talking about, as you understood it, because in the context of the conversation, is that what he owed him were these investigations that he wanted.
That would have been to fix the wrong, exactly.
And those investigations into the 2016 election and Biden and Burisma.
That's correct.
Now, during this early period in September, we've talked a little bit about the fact that you continually heard that the president was repeatedly saying that there was no quid pro quo. Is that right?
That's correct.
And he still says that repeatedly today. But regardless of what you call it, whether it's a quid pro quo, bribery, extortion, abuse of power of the office of the presidency, the fact of the matter, as you understood it, is that security assistance and the White House meeting were not going to be provided unless Ukraine initiated these two investigations that would benefit Donald Trump's reelection. Is that what you understood the facts to be?
Mr. Goldman, what I can do here for you today is tell you what I heard from people. And in this case, it was what I heard from Ambassador Sondland. He described conditions for the security assistance and the White House meeting in those terms. That is, that were dependent upon, conditioned on, pursuing these investigations.
And you heard that from Ambassador Sondland himself, correct?
Correct.
And you also heard a similar story from Mr. Morrison as well, is that right?
Who also talked to Ambassador Sondland about the conversations that he had had in Warsaw with Ukrainians.
And what Mr. Morrison recounted to you was substantially similar to what Mr. Sondland recounted to you, right?
Yes.
And so, regardless of what Ukrainians may say now that everything is out in the public and we're here in this public hearing, that they felt no pressure from President Trump, it was your clear understanding, was it not, that in early September, when the pressure campaign was still secret, that the Ukrainians believed that they needed to announce these public investigations? Is that right?
Ms. Goldman, I know that the Ukrainians were very concerned about the security assistance. And I know that they were prepared or preparing to make a public statement, that is, with a CNN interview, that that was being planned. Those are the two pieces that I know.
And that CNN interview was to announce these investigations as you understood it, right?
That was the implication. That was certainly the implication.
We've been focused a lot on the September time frame, but I want to go back 2 months to July, before the July 25th call. And you testified, Ambassador Taylor, in your opening statement that it was in the middle of July when you understood that the White House meeting was first a condition on these investigations. Is that accurate?
Yes. We were preparing, and I agreed that the White House meeting was going to be an important step in U.S.-Ukrainian relations. So in June and in early July, attempts to work out a way to get that meeting included a phone call. And so there were several conversations about how to have this phone call that eventually happened on July 25th.
And you described in your opening statement a July 10th White House meeting with a number of officials where Ambassador Bolton used the term that something was a drug deal. What did you understand him to mean in hearing that he said that used this term drug deal?
Ms. Comer, I don't know. I don't know what Ambassador Bolton had in mind.
And was that in reference to a discussion in that meeting related to the White House meeting that President Zelensky wanted and in connection to the investigations?
The context of that comment was the discussion that Mr. Danyluk, who was Mr. Bolton's counterpart, Ukrainian counterpart, the National Security Advisor, had with Mr. Bolton. And that conversation was very substantive up until the point where the White House meeting was raised and Mr. Ambassador Sondland intervened to talk about the investigations. It was at that point that Ambassador Bolton ceased the meeting, closed the meeting, finished the meeting, and told his staff to report this meeting to the lawyers. And he also later then indicated to Fiona Hill, who was also a participant on NSC staff, that he, Ambassador Bolton, didn't want to be associated with this drug deal. So it was, and the implication was it was the domestic politics that was being cooked up.
And did Ambassador Sondland say this in front of the Ukrainian officials, to your understanding?
Ambassador Sondland, in the meeting where Ambassador Bolton was having a conversation with his counterpart, raised the issue of investigations being important to come before the White House meeting that had just been raised.
And Ukrainian officials were there.
And Ukrainian officials were in that meeting, yes, sir.
Now, around this same time in mid-July, did you have any discussions with Ukrainian officials about these investigations?
I don't recall.
Well, let me show you a text message that you wrote on July 21st, where you wrote it again to Ambassadors Sondland and Volker. And if you could just read what you wrote here on July 21st.
Gordon, one thing Kurt and I talked about yesterday was Sasha Danieluk's point that President Zelensky is sensitive about Ukraine being taken seriously, not merely as an instrument in Washington domestic reelection politics.
And Sasha Danieluk, I think you just said, is Ambassador Bolton's counterpart, right?
He's the national security advisor to the... It was. He's no longer, but was at the time.
What did you understand it to mean when that Zelensky had concerns about being an instrument in Washington domestic reelection politics?
Mr. Danieluk understood that these investigations were pursuant to Mr. Giuliani's request to develop information, to find information about Burisma and the Bidens. This was very well known in public. Mr. Giuliani had made this point clear in several instances in the beginning, in the springtime. And Mr. Danieluk was aware that that was a problem.
And would you agree that because President Zelensky is worried about this, they understood at least that there was some pressure for them to pursue these investigations? Is that fair?
Mr. Danieluk indicated that President Zelensky certainly understood it, that he did not want to get involved in these type of activities.
Now, I'm going to move ahead now to July 25th, which was when President Trump and President Zelensky had the phone call. But before we get to the phone call, I want to show both of you a text message, neither of you is on this text message. It is between Ambassador Volker and Andrei Yermak, a top aide to President Zelensky. I will read it because neither of you is on it. Ambassador Volker says, "Good lunch. Thanks. Heard from White House. Assuming President Z convinces Trump he will investigate/get to the bottom of what happened in 2016, we will nail down date for visit to Washington. Good luck. See you tomorrow. Kurt." And this was a half hour, less than a half hour, before the call actually occurred. Now, Ambassador Taylor, was Ambassador Volker with you in Ukraine at this time?
He was.
Did you know that he was prepping President Zelensky for this phone call with President Trump in this way?
Not in this way, Mr. Goldman, but I knew that Ambassador Volker was prepping Ukrainians for the phone call earlier on. That is, at a meeting in Toronto on July 2nd. Ambassador Volker had a conversation with President Zelensky and had indicated in a phone call that he, at that time, was going to talk Mr. Zelensky, President Zelensky, through the steps that need to be taken in order to get to the phone call.
Understood. And you testified earlier that the security assistance had already been frozen, to your knowledge, at least by July 18th. Is that right?
That's correct.
So that was just a week earlier than this.
That's correct.
So just so we're clear, Ambassador Taylor, before this July 25th call, President Trump had frozen the security assistance that Ukraine needed, and that the White House meeting was conditioned on Ukraine initiating this investigation, and that had been relayed to the Ukrainians. Is that an accurate state of play at this time?
That's an accurate state of play. I, at that point, had no indication that any discussion of the security assistance being subject to conditioned on investigations had taken place.
Right. But you understood that the White House meeting was.
That's correct.
All right, let's move ahead to this July 25th call and between the presidents. Now, am I correct that neither of you were on this call? Is that right, Mr. Kent?
That's correct.
And you were neither as well? So you both read it after it was released publicly at the end of September?
Yes.
Yes.
I want to spend just a little time reading the transcript, as we've been encouraged to do. And I want to particularly note four excerpts of the transcript. One that relates to the security assistance we've been talking about. Another that discusses a favor that President Trump asked of President Zelensky. A third where President Trump asks the Ukrainian president to investigate his political opponent, former Vice President Biden. And then a final one where the Ukrainian president directly links the desired White House visit to the political investigations that President Trump wanted. So let's look at the first excerpt, which is near the beginning of the call when President Zelensky discusses the military aid that the U.S. provides to Ukraine. He says, "I would also like to thank you for your great support in the area of defense. We are ready to continue to cooperate for the next steps. Specifically, we are almost ready to buy more javelins from the United States for defense purposes." Now, at the time of this phone call, Ambassador Taylor and Mr. Kent, you both knew that the aid had been frozen. Is that right?
That's correct.
And Ambassador Taylor, you testified that President Trump obviously also knew that the aid had been frozen as well, since he was responsible for doing that. Is that correct?
That's what I had been told. That's what we heard on that conference call, yes.
But to neither of your knowledge, the Ukrainians were not aware of that at that point?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to my knowledge.
But right after President Zelensky thanks President Trump for his great support in the area of defense, President Trump then says, and we'll go to the next excerpt, "I want you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people. The server, they say Ukraine has it." And then at the end of the paragraph, he says, "Whatever you can do, it's very important that you do it if that's possible." Now, Mr. Kent, you've testified a little bit about how important this White House meeting was to President Zelensky. How would you expect a new Ukrainian president to interpret a request for a favor from the President of the United States?
I cannot interpret the mind of President Zelensky, other than to say that it was very clear that what they were hoping to get out of this meeting was a date and a confirmation that he could come to Washington.
Obviously, you can't put yourself in the mind, but if the Ukrainian president, for a country that's so dependent on the United States for all things, including military assistance, is requested to do a favor, how do you think the Ukrainians would interpret that?
Well, if you go further into the call record as part of this, and we don't have it on screen, but to the best of my recollection, reading it after it was released on September 25th, President Zelensky went into having whatever your problems were. That was the old team. I've got a new team, and we will do whatever is appropriate and be transparent and honest about it. I don't remember the exact words, but he was trying to be, in his own words, in response, be responsive to conduct the business of Ukrainian government in a transparent and honest manner.
Now, when he talks about this CrowdStrike and the server, what do you understand this to be a reference to?
To be honest, I had not heard of CrowdStrike until I read this transcript on September 25th.
Do you now understand what it relates to?
I understand it has to do with the story that there's a server with missing emails. I also understand that one of the owners of of CrowdStrike is a Russian-American. I'm not aware of any Ukrainian connection to the company.
Now, are you aware that this is all part of a larger allegation that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election?
Yes, that is my understanding.
And to your knowledge, is there any factual basis to support the allegation that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election?
To my knowledge, there is no factual basis, no.
And in fact, who did interfere in the 2016 election?
I think it's amply clear that Russian interference was at the heart of the interference in the 2016 election cycle.
Let's move to the third excerpt that I mentioned related to Vice President Biden. And it says, the other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son. This is President Trump speaking, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible. Now, at the time of this call, Vice President Biden was the front runner for the Democratic nomination in the 2020 election. And Mr. Krent, are you familiar, as you indicate in your opening statement, about these allegations related to Vice President Biden?
I am.
And to your knowledge, is there any factual basis to support those allegations?
None whatsoever.
When Vice President Biden acted in Ukraine, did he act in accordance with official U.S. policy?
He did.
Now, let's go to then the last excerpt that I wanted to highlight, which is President Zelensky speaking. And he says, I also wanted to thank you for your invitation to visit the United States, specifically Washington, D.C. On the other hand, I also want to assure you that we will be very serious about the case, and we will work on the investigation. Now, Ambassador Taylor, right after President Zelensky mentions his much-desired Washington visit, he says, on the other hand, and then says that Ukraine will be very serious about the investigation. Is this the same link between the White House visit and the investigations that Ambassador Volker had texted to Andrei Yermak just a few minutes before this conversation?
That's my assumption.
Now, just to summarize what we've just read in this July 25th call between the presidents, the Ukrainian president thanked President Trump for security assistance that President Trump had just frozen, to which President Trump responded that he wanted President Zelensky to do him a favor, though, by investigating the 2016 U.S. election and the Bidens. Then President Zelensky says that he will pursue these investigations right after he mentions the White House visit. Is that your understanding, Ambassador Taylor, of what we just read?
Yes.
And Mr. Ken, is that yours?
Yes.
I yield back.
But Ambassador Taylor, you testified to this committee that you only recently became aware of reports of this cooperation between Ukrainian embassy officials and Chalupa to undermine the Trump campaign. From your last deposition, is that correct?
Mr. Nunes, it is correct that I had not known about this before.
I'm just going over your last deposition.
That's exactly right.
Ambassador.
Yep.
The Politico article cites three named Ukrainian officials asserting that the Ukrainian embassy supported the Hillary Clinton campaign. It quotes Ukrainian parliamentarian Andrei Artemenko saying, quote, it was clear they were supporting Hillary Clinton's candidacy. They did everything from organizing meetings with the Clinton team to publicly supporting her to criticizing Trump. I think that they simply didn't meet with the Trump campaign because they thought Hillary would win. Unquote. Ambassador Taylor, you testified you were unfamiliar with that statement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You also said you were unaware that then Ukrainian ambassador to the U.S., Valery Chalet, wrote an op-ed in The Hill during the 2016 presidential campaign criticizing then-candidate Trump. Is that correct?
That is correct.
You said you did not know that Sergei Lyshenko, then a Ukrainian parliamentarian, had admitted that part of his motivation in spreading information about the so-called Black Ledger, a disputed document purporting to reveal corruption by a former Trump campaign official, was to undermine the Trump's candidacy. This was in your deposition. Is that still correct?
That is still correct, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Fusion GPS contractor Nelly Orr testified to Congress that Lyshenko was a source for Fusion GPS's operation to dirty up the Trump campaign, including the compilation of the Steele dossier on behalf of the DNC and the Clinton campaign. You testified you were unaware that Lyshenko served as a source for that project. Ambassador Taylor, is this still correct?
It is, sir.
You said you did not know that Ukrainian Internal Affairs Minister Arsen Avakov mocked and disparaged then-candidate Trump on Facebook and Twitter. Is that still correct?
That is correct.
Ambassador Taylor, in your testimony to this committee, you said you were never briefed on these reports and statements, that you did not do due diligence before taking your post to discover that the president's and Mayor Giuliani's concerns may have been, and that you did what they may have been, and that you did not discuss them with Ambassador Yovanovitch. That's still correct?
Yes, sir.
Furthermore, you said it upset you to hear about the many indications of Ukrainian election meddling. Your precise words were, I'm going to read them back to you, based on this political article, which again surprises me, disappoints me, because I think it's a mistake for any diplomat or government official in one country to interfere in the political life of another. That's disappointing, unquote. Ambassador Taylor, is that still your testimony?
Mr. Hearns, it is. Subsequent to that, I looked into the circumstances for several of the things that you just mentioned. In 2016, candidate Trump had made a statement saying that it was possible that he would allow Crimea to go back to Russia. He expressed that the sentiment or the opinion that it was possible that Crimea wanted to go back to Russia. What I can tell you, Ms. Nunes, is that that sentiment is amazingly inflammatory to all Ukrainians. So
I can understand that. Are you aware during the, I believe it was the 2012 election, when at the time President Obama leaned over on a hot mic to the then Russian president and said that he'd have to wait till after the election? Was that inflammatory to the Ukrainians also?
I don't know, sir.
And with that, I'll turn to Mr. Castor.
Ambassador Taylor, Mr. Kent, President Trump's concerns about Ukraine's role in the 2016 election, you believe he genuinely believed they were working against him, right? Ambassador Taylor?
Mr. Castor, I don't know what President or candidate Trump was thinking about the Ukrainians.
I mean, didn't he in this Oval Office meeting on May 23rd after the Zelensky inauguration, didn't he lament that the Ukrainians were out to get him?
I heard that his response to the suggestion that Mr. Zelensky visit Mr. Trump, President Trump, in the Oval Office was not well received, and that he had concerns about Ukrainians, yes.
But from the president's perspective, if the ambassador, Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, one of the most influential diplomats, is penning an op-ed, certainly with the okay of President Poroshenko, the DNC consultants are conferring with Ukrainian officials at the embassy. Former Prime Minister Yatseniak is saying things on social media. Interior Minister Avakov, who has spanned both the Poroshenko and the Zelensky realm, is also saying some very unkind things on social media about the president. You certainly can appreciate that President Trump was very concerned that some elements of the Ukrainian establishment were not in favor of him, did not support him, and were out to get him.
If I go to, and I'll allow the question, but
Parliamentary Inquiry, are you seriously interrupting our time here?
I will allow the question. I won't dock this from the time. I just want to be clear, Ambassador. If you're able to verify the things that counsel has asked you in the prerequisite of the question, that's fine. Otherwise, in questions from the majority or the minority that may assume facts not in evidence before you, you should be cautioned about that.
So you certainly can appreciate President Trump's concerns.
Ms. Kastner, I don't know the exact nature of President Trump's concerns. In my deposition, I recall you handed me the Politico article, which listed at least three of the elements that you have described earlier. And you've recognized, and I have confirmed with the ranking minority member, that first I'd heard of those and was surprised by those. I don't know President Trump's reaction to those.
In the information published by Sergei Leshenko, former Ukrainian investigative journalist, and then he was a member of the parliament, about the Manafort black ledgers in August of 2016. The very day that was published, Mr. Manafort resigned from the campaign, correct?
I don't know, Mr. Kastner.
But certainly that gives rise to some concern that there are elements of the Ukrainian establishment that were out to get the president. That's a very reasonable belief of his, correct?
I don't know.
The run-up to the 2016 election, there's many facts that remain unresolved. Agreed?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
There are many facts relating to the run-up of the 2016 election that remain unresolved.
Any further?
Well, Attorney General Barr, in May of 2019, tasked the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut, John Durham, to broadly examine the government's collection of intelligence involving the president's campaign. That effort, initially was an administrative review, has turned into a criminal probe. And U.S. Attorney Durham is casting a wide net and is following the facts where they may lead. Are you aware of that?
I'm aware that there is an investigation. That's as much as I'm aware.
And so to the extent any information resides in Ukraine, it's perfectly appropriate for the Ukrainians to try to get to the bottom of that, for the Ukrainians to cooperate with the United States through official channels to share that information, correct?
Ms. Kastner, can you say that one again? I'd appreciate it if you would restate the question.
To the extent Ukraine has facts related to the run-up of the 2016 election that are under the U.S. Attorney Durham's probe, Ukraine should cooperate with the United States, and to the extent there are Ukrainians doing improper things, the Ukrainians ought to investigate that themselves, correct?
Ms. Kastner, the Ukrainian-American relations are very supportive. The Ukrainians will certainly be responsive to requests.
So when the president on the call transcript of July 25th raises this with President Zelensky, and he urges that there be a connection between the Ukrainian government and the Justice Department officially, I mean, that's the appropriate way to raise an issue with the Ukrainian president, correct?
It's appropriate for the Justice Department and the Prosecutor General to cooperate and to exchange information, yes.
But to the extent the president has concerns and to the extent the Attorney General is having the U.S. Attorney Durham look into that, isn't it entirely appropriate for the president to flag this for President Zelensky? and say that you should be in touch with our official channels?
Ms. Castro, I don't know the precise appropriateness of these kinds of relations.
Now, were you involved, either of you, involved with the preparation for the 725 call?
I was not.
I was not.
And how do you account for that? I mean, you were the two of the key officials with responsibility for Ukrainian policy. I mean, if the President of the United States is going to have a call with the leader of Ukraine, why wouldn't you ordinarily be involved with the preparation?
Sir, we work for the Department of State in an embassy overseas, and in preparation for a presidential phone call, that responsibility lies within the staff of the National Security Council. Normally, if there is enough sufficient time, National Security staff can solicit information, usually from the State Department, and we can draw on the embassy, but that's only background information. And my understanding, having never worked at the National Security Council, is that National Security staff write a memo to the President, and none of us see that outside of the National Security staff.
Okay, so the chargé or the U.S. ambassador to the country wouldn't ordinarily be on a call with a foreign leader?
That's correct. Would not.
And did Colonel Vindman or anyone at the National Security Council staff reach out to you, Mr. Kent, in preparation for the call?
I was given notification the day before on July 24th, and to the extent I had any role, it was to reach out to the embassy, give them the heads up, and ask them to ensure that the secure communications link in the Office of the President of Ukraine was functional so the call could be patched through from the White House Situation Room.
Did you provide any substantive advice to Colonel Vindman about the call and what ought to be the official position?
I was not asked, and I did not provide.
Okay. Same with you, Ambassador?
The same.
And the call was scheduled, you know, you testified earlier that the call was on again, off again. And after the July 10th meeting with Ambassador Bolton, the consensus was the call was not going to happen. Is that correct?
I would not say that was a consensus. The State Department's position was that a call between the two presidents would be useful. Mm-hmm. And once Zelensky's party won the first ever absolute majority in parliamentary elections on July 21st, the idea of a congratulatory call made eminent sense from our perspective.
Okay, and the call was scheduled. And did you get a readout, Ambassador Taylor, initially from the call?
I didn't, Mr. Castor. We all read the statement that the Ukrainians put out. I got a readout several days later from Mr. Morrison, National Security Council.
Okay. And how about you, Mr. Kent?
I likewise first saw the Ukrainian statement, and I believe the next day, July 26th, which would have been a Friday, I did get a partial readout from mm-hmm. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, yes.
Ambassador Taylor, you said that the Ukrainian readout was cryptic. Is that just because it's initially written in Ukrainian and translated to the U.S.?
No, it's as a general rule, both United States and other countries, including Ukraine, will put out very short summaries that kind of hit the highlights okay. of the discussion, but without going into detail.
Okay. And you mentioned it was cryptic. Why did you think it was cryptic?
Knowing now what, having read the transcript and looking back at their summary, mm-hmm. As I recall, I don't recall the exact words, but they said that there were issues to be pursued in order to improve relations between the two countries or something like that.
That seems pretty ordinary.
It seems pretty ordinary.
You were with President Zelensky the very next day?
We were. We had a meeting with him the very next day.
And did President Zelensky raise any concerns about his views of the call?
He said, I... Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland were in his office, and we asked him, I think, how the call. He said, call was fine. I was happy with the call.
Okay. And did you get any additional readouts subsequently about the call? Like, when did you first learn that the call contained things that concerned you? Was that not until September 25th?
Mr. Morrison, as I say, briefed me several days later, before the end of July. I think this is where I said in my testimony that he said it could have gone better. Mm-hmm. He said the call mentioned Mr. Giuliani. Mm-hmm. He also said that the call mentioned the former ambassador. Both of those were concerning.
Giuliani was first raised on the call by President Zelensky, correct?
I don't recall.
Okay.
It could have been. Well, I have it here if you'd like.
Yeah, it's on page
very good.
Page 3. The first mention of Giuliani is from President Zelensky, and it's on page 3. And President Zelensky says, I will personally tell you that one of my assistants spoke with Mr. Giuliani just recently, and we are hoping very much that Mr. Giuliani will be able to travel to Ukraine, and we will meet once he comes to Ukraine. Did that surprise you?
Again, I didn't have the transcript at the time. All I heard was that Giuliani was mentioned. Mr. Morrison said that Giuliani was mentioned in the call.
But the way Zelensky states it here, it sounds like he is very much looking forward to speaking with America's mayor.
That's what I found out when I read the transcript on the 25th of September or so.
Okay. Now, Mr. Kent, corruption in Ukraine is endemic, correct?
That's correct.
And it affects the courts, the prosecutors, and there have historically been problems with all the prosecutors in Ukraine, correct?
I would say up until the new set of prosecutors appointed by President Zelensky in the last 2 months, correct.
Okay. And so the U.S. government, the consensus hope at the State Department and the National Security Council and the White House is that Zelensky's the real deal. He's a real reformer. He's genuinely interested in rooting out corruption, prosecuting the bad guys, correct?
I would say we are cautiously optimistic, and we will work wherever there is the political will mm-hmm. to do the right thing and put forward genuine reform.
And at the heart of the corruption is this oligarchical system, correct? Where the oligarchs take control, often by a virtual theft of, for example, the right to certain energy licenses, correct?
That is one element, yes, sir.
And the company Burisma, its leader Sochevsky, he has a little bit of a storied history of corruption, doesn't he?
Mr. Zlochevsky was Minister of Energy from 2010 to 2012 under the pro-Russian government, and he used his regulatory authority to award gas exploration licenses to companies that he himself controlled. That would be considered an act of corruption, in my view, yes.
And certainly self-dealing.
Certainly self-dealing and self-enriching.
And how did the Ukrainian government ultimately pursue that?
In the spring of 2014, the Ukrainian government, the new government after the Revolution of Dignity, turned to partners, particularly the U.S. and the U.K., to try to recover tens of billions of dollars of stolen assets. The first case that we tried to recover that money came from Mr. Zlochevsky. The Serious Crimes Office in the U.K. had already opened up an investigation. They worked with us and the Ukrainian authorities to develop more information. The $23 million was frozen. Until somebody in the General Prosecutor's Office of Ukraine shut the case, issued a letter to his lawyer, and that money went poof.
So essentially paid a bribe to make the case go away?
That is our strong assumption, yes, sir.
Okay. Now, at any point in time, has anyone in the Ukrainian government tried to reinvestigate that, or did those crimes just go unpunished, and was he free to go?
Mr. Zlochevsky spent time, as far as I understand, in Moscow and Monaco after he fled Ukraine. We continued to raise as a point of order that because U.S. taxpayer dollars had been used to try to recover frozen assets, that we have a fiduciary responsibility, and we continued to press Ukrainian officials to answer for why alleged corrupt prosecutors had closed a case. And we have, till now, not gotten a satisfactory answer. So, to summarize, we thought that Mykola Zlochevsky had stolen money. We thought a prosecutor had taken a bribe to shut the case, and those were our main concerns.
And are you in favor of that matter being fully investigated and prosecuted?
I think since U.S. taxpayer dollars are wasted, I would love to see the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's office find who the corrupt prosecutor was that took the bribe and how much it was paid. And that's what I said to the Deputy Prosecutor General on February 3rd, 2015.
But in addition to prosecuting the person that took the bribes, shouldn't the organization or individual that sponsored the bribes be prosecuted?
I would agree that the Ukrainian law authorities should uphold the rule of law and hold people account for breaking Ukrainian law.
So this company, Burisma, involved in lots of criminal activity, correct?
I do not know that.
But over the years, it's been involved in a number of questionable dealings, correct?
I would say that it's the largest private gas producer in the country, and its business reputation is mixed.
So to the extent a new regime is coming in under President Zelensky, it certainly would be fair for the new prosecutor, a genuine prosecutor, to reexamine old crimes that hadn't sufficiently been brought to justice, right?
I believe that the new Prosecutor General, Ruslan Rybashapka, made a statement to that end that they would be reviewing past cases. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind, this is a country where those that commit crimes generally never get held to account, so there's a lot to review.
Okay. Now, this the bribe was paid in what year?
To the best of my knowledge, the case against Zlochevsky, the former minister, was shut down December of 2014.
Okay. And right around that time, Burisma starts adding officials to its board. Is that correct?
Understanding is, yes, that Zlochevsky invited a series of new individuals to join the board in 2014.
And do you know what his strategy was in adding officials to his board?
I have never met Mr. Zlochevsky.
Okay. And who are some of the folks he added to the board?
The most prominent person he added to the board was the former president of Poland, Aleksander Kwaśniewski.
And anyone else?
There were a number of others, including some Americans, and the most prominent one in this context is Hunter Biden.
Okay, so Hunter Biden's added to the board of Burisma. Now, do you think that creates a problem that Burisma may be adding people to its board for protection purposes?
Sir, I work for the government. I don't work in the corporate sector, and so I believe that companies build their boards with a variety of reasons, not only to promote their business plans.
Was Hunter Biden a corporate governance expert?
I have no idea what Hunter Biden studied at university or what his CV says.
Mike, is he the Jeffrey Sonnenfeld of the Ukraine?
I have no awareness or knowledge of what his background was and what he may have done on the border.
Okay, so you don't know whether he has any business experience in Ukraine prior to joining Burisma's board?
I've heard nothing about prior experience.
Okay, no. Do you know if he speaks Ukrainian?
I do not.
Do you know if he possesses any other element other than the fact that he is the son of, at the time, the sitting vice president?
I do not.
Okay. Ambassador Taylor, do you know whether Hunter Biden offers anything other than the fact that his dad's the former vice president?
I don't.
Or at the time was the vice president?
I have no knowledge of Hunter Biden.
But you would agree it raises questions, right? He was getting paid, I think, $50,000 a month to sit on the board. Did you know if he relocated to Ukraine?
I'm sorry, Mr. Kessler, say again.
Do you know if Hunter Biden relocated to Ukraine?
No knowledge.
Do you know, Mr. Kent?
Again, no knowledge.
Okay. So he's getting paid $50,000 a month, but we don't know whether he had any experience, he had any, he spoke the language, or whether he moved to Ukraine, correct?
Correct.
Now, at this time, Vice President Biden was taking a specific interest in Ukraine, wasn't he?
He was.
And could you tell us about that?
I believe while he was vice president, he made a total of 6 visits to Ukraine. One may have been during the old regime, Yanukovych, and that would make 5 visits after the Revolution of Dignity, which started February of 2014.
Okay, and you were the DCM, the Deputy Chief of Mission at the time, correct?
Starting in 2015, yes.
Okay, and did Vice President Biden come when you were at post?
He did not. I came back for Ukrainian language training, and so I missed several visits.
Now you've seen Vice President Biden's he's sort of given a speech, and he's a little folksy about how he went into Ukraine and he told the Ukrainians that if they don't fire the prosecutor, they're going to lose their $1 billion in loan guarantees. You've seen that, correct?
I have. I think it was a speech at the Council of Foreign Relations in January 2018.
Right. And he also said that he's been there, you know, to Ukraine 13 times. Do you know if that's accurate?
To the best of my knowledge, when he was vice president, he made 6 visits.
And did the State Department ever express any concerns to the vice president's office that the vice president's role at the time in engaging on Ukraine presented any issues?
No, the vice president's role was critically important. It was top cover to help us pursue our policy agenda.
Okay, but given Hunter Biden's role in Burisma's board of directors, at some point you testified in your deposition that you expressed some concern to the vice president's office. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what did they do about that concern that you expressed?
I have no idea. I reported my concern to the office of the vice president.
Okay, and that was the end of it, and that nobody...
You would have to ask people who worked in the office of the vice president during 2015.
But after you expressed the concern of a perceived conflict of interest, at the least, the vice president's engagement in Ukraine didn't decrease, did it?
Correct, because the vice president was promoting U.S. policy objectives in Ukraine.
And Hunter Biden's role on the board of Burisma didn't cease, did it?
To the best of my knowledge, it didn't, and my concern was that there was the possibility of a perception of a conflict of interest.
Now, Ambassador Taylor, I want to turn to the discussion of the irregular channel you describe. And in fairness, this irregular channel of diplomacy, it's not as outlandish as it could be. Is that correct?
It's not as outlandish as it could be. Yeah, I agree, Mr. Kass.
Okay, we have Ambassador Volker, who's a former Senate-confirmed ambassador to NATO, a longtime State Department diplomat. And you've known Ambassador Volker for years, correct?
That's correct.
A man of unquestioned integrity, correct?
That's correct.
And somebody with incredible knowledge of the region.
With very good knowledge of the region. Yes,
and the best interests of the United States.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right.
And the best interests of Ukraine.
His first priority is clearly the United States.
Okay.
And to the extent that Ukraine has an implication for that, yes.
Okay.
Ukraine as well.
And the second member of the irregular channel is Ambassador Sondland, who is Senate confirmed, ambassador to the EU. So his involvement here, while, you know, not necessarily part of his official duties as the ambassador to the EU, is certainly is not outlandish for him to be interested and engaged pursuant to the president or Secretary Pompeo's direction. Correct?
It's a little unusual for the U.S. ambassador to the EU to play a role in Ukraine policy.
Okay. And, you know, it might be irregular, but it's certainly not outlandish. And then Secretary Perry is the third member of the irregular channel. Certainly a, you know, Senate-confirmed official, somebody with deep experience in energy markets. And he was pursuing some, you know, liquefied natural gas projects in Ukraine.
That's correct, Ms. Kessler.
So his involvement, Secretary Perry's involvement, is perfectly acceptable?
It is.
Okay. Now, This irregular channel, as it developed, when did you determine that it became problematic? I mean, you in your opening statement, identified yourself appropriately as the leader of the regular channel.
At least a participant. Here's another leader of the regular channel.
So when did you first develop concerns that the irregular channel was being problematic?
So I arrived in Kyiv in mid-September. By late September, a couple of phone calls with...
Yeah, you arrived in Kyiv in June, right?
June. Sorry.
June 17th?
Mid-June.
Yep.
June 17th. Thank you. And so by the end of June... I had begun to hear references to investigations as something that would have to happen prior to the meeting that President Trump had offered to President Zelensky.
Okay.
And that began to raise questions for me.
Okay. Now you've known Ambassador Volker, and you've certainly have a reason to know Ambassador Sondland. What did you do at this point, or did you ever try to wrest control of the irregular channel?
I didn't try to wrest control of the irregular channel do that. At the time when I
Why not though? If you have these concerns.
Because Ms. Castor, at the time as Ambassador Kent, no, Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent testified, both channels were interested in having a meeting between President Zelensky and President Trump. So there's no reason to kind of wrest control if we're going in the same direction.
But at some point, you developed concerns. I mean, your opening statement is here. I mean, you're the impeachment witness number one, and you're number two, Mr. Kent. You know, for the case impeaching the president of the United States because of the concerns you've testified about the irregular channel, correct?
I was concerned when the irregular channel appeared to be going against the irregular channel was going against the overall direction of and purpose of the regular channel.
So, and as I understand the record, however, when you arrived in Ukraine, you had the support of the secretary and the secretary's top advisor, Chancellor Ulrich Brechbuhl, correct?
That is correct.
And they assured you that if you had any concerns, you would be able to contact them and they would have your back.
That is correct.
And you knew going in that the Rudy Giuliani element presented some complexities, correct?
I was concerned about Rudy Giuliani's statements and involvement in the Ukraine policy, yes.
Okay. So when it genuinely became, you know, a concern for you, what did you do to either engage Sondland and Volker and Perry, Giuliani? By the way, have you ever met Rudy Giuliani during these times relevant?
Not during the times relevant. Mr. Giuliani visited Ukraine one time when I was there, I think in 2007 or 8.
Okay.
That's the only time I've met him.
Okay. So you've never had any communications with Rudy Giuliani as part of these irregular channel business?
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. And anyway, getting back to my question, did you try to engage Brechbuhl or the secretary during this time period? I know you said that you had, I believe, an August 21st or 22nd telephone call with Brechbuhl. You had a July 10th telephone call with Brechbuhl, and then you sent a first-person cable to the secretary on August 29th.
That's correct.
Is that sort of the universe of initiatives you took inside the State Department to raise your concerns about the irregular channel?
I also raised my concerns with Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent. In particular, early on when I think I may have mentioned this phone call that was odd in that it did not include the normal staff, indeed, Ambassador Sondland's staff, and that struck me as unusual. I consulted with Mr. Kent, and at his suggestion, made a note of this, and also had, I think at that point, I had a conversation with Mr. Brechbuhl.
That was a June 28th call, I believe?
That's correct.
And in your opening statement, you expressed some concerns about what Ambassador Sondland had said, but then once Zelensky got on the phone, it proceeded in a very regular channel way, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So the June 28th call, at least in and of itself, didn't ultimately, as it played out, present any problems for you?
The call with President Zelensky did not. The preparation for that call, the preparation included maybe 15 minutes of just the Americans that would stay on the call.
Right.
And that was a little irregular in that it didn't have the staff. It was also in that pre-call, in that 15 minutes,
before President Zelensky got on the phone, where Ambassador Volker told the rest of the participants that he was planning to have a conversation with President Zelensky in Toronto in 3 days, 4 days, where he would outline for President Zelensky the important components of the phone call that we were trying to establish.
Okay. And you didn't have any issue with that, did you?
The only issue I had with that, Mr. Kastner, was there was reference to investigations in, I believe that's, I'll have to check my notes on that, but there was raised issues for me that I didn't understand what Ambassador Volker had in mind that he was specifically going to raise with Mr. Zelensky. That was a little bit of a concern.
Okay. I mean, the president's expressed his, you know, interest in certain investigations, certainly relating to the 2016 election and relating to, you know, this corrupt Burisma outfit. So that wasn't inconsistent with the president's message, right?
I'm not sure, Mr. Kastner. Maybe can I ask you to repeat the question?
The president's concerns about the 2016 election and needing to get to the bottom of it, and the president's concerns, is it ultimately related to the Burisma company? I mean, if Ambassador Volker is raising that with Zelensky, that's consistent with the direction of the president, correct?
The president's interest, or I would say Mr. Giuliani's interest, because that's what we were, that's what was very clear at the time.
Right.
Mr. Giuliani's interest in pursuing these investigations was of concern, but.
Yeah, by the way, do you know how many times Volker met with Giuliani?
I don't.
How many would you guess? Is it, like, was he talking to him all the time or meeting with him all the time?
Mr. Kastner, I don't know.
Okay. From his, his deposition, he told us just once. And, you know, he texted back and forth with the mayor, and it had a call or two. But it wasn't a pervasive engagement for Ambassador Volker. Were you aware of that?
I was not aware. I was aware of one breakfast, I think, but that's the only one that I was aware of.
And Mr. Kent, before my time expires, I want to circle back to the company of Burisma. And you testified at your deposition that there was an instance where USAID had engaged with Burisma and possibly sponsoring a program, and you took issue with that and recommended USAID to pull back from that. Could you tell us about that?
So I became aware in the summer, I believe, of 2016 that as a part of what I recall was a clean energy awareness campaign, the part of the USAID mission that worked on economics and governance, including energy, had sponsored some sort of contest for young Ukrainians to come up with a theme, and there was a prize. I believe it may have been a camera. And they had co-sponsored, and with public-private partnership being a buzzword, having a co-sponsorship with Burisma. Given the past history of our interest in recovering stolen assets from Zlochevsky, it was my view that it was inappropriate for the embassy to be co-sponsoring a contest with Burisma. I raised that with the mission director at the embassy. She agreed, and the USAID mission kept the contest, but dropped the public-private partnership sponsorship.
The time of the gentleman has expired. We'll now move to five-minute member rounds. I recognize myself for 5 minutes. Mr. Kent, I want to follow up on my colleague's questions regarding Burisma. You testified about a time when an oligarch named Zlochevsky, I think it was self-dealing, awarding himself contracts. When was that?
To the best of my knowledge, he was Minister of Ecology under President Yanukovych from 2010 to 2012. And at the time, licenses to have substrata exploration of gas were awarded by a subdivision of the Ministry of Ecology.
So this corrupt self-dealing than was approximately 7 years, at least 7 years before the events that bring us here today, the phone call on the 25th and the events around it?
Correct. His time as minister was 2010 to 2012. Hunter Biden joined the board of Burisma in 2014.
And you've read the call transcript, have you not?
I have, and I have it in front of me, but I haven't read it for about a month.
Is there any mention in the discussion with President Trump and President Zelensky of this oligarch, Zelensky, who 7 years earlier had been self-dealing?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Is there a discussion of awarding contracts to oneself or the corrupt acts in the 2012 to 2014 timeframe?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
No, what the president brings up is CrowdStrike, the server, and the Bidens. Am I right?
I see that here, yes.
There was no discussion on that call of setting up an anti-corruption court or looking into corruption among oligarchs or companies in general. The president's comments were focused on two things, 2016 and the Bidens. Am I right?
I believe so, yes.
Now, you testified in your opening statement, I do not believe the United States should ask other countries to engage in selective politically associated investigations or prosecutions against opponents of those in power, because such selective actions undermine the rule of law regardless of the country. The selective politically associated investigations or prosecutions against opponents of those in power, are you referring to the Bidens there?
I'm referring as a general principle about the promotion of the rule of law.
But that would apply to the President of the United States seeking an investigation of his political opponent, would it not?
It could be interpreted that way, yes, sir.
And I take it in your discussions, Ambassador Taylor, with Ambassador Sondland or others, what was communicated to you was that the president wanted investigations into 2016 and the Bidens, not into an oligarch named Zelensky or self-dealing, but 2016 and the Bidens. Was that your understanding?
That was my understanding.
And in fact, when you said your staff overheard this call between Ambassador Sondland and the president, in that call, the president brings up investigation, does he not?
He did.
And immediately after the president gets off the phone with Sondland, Sondland is asked by your staff, what does the president think about Ukraine? And his answer is, he's just interested in the Bidens. Am I right?
He said he was more interested in the Bidens.
More interested in the Bidens. No discussion of Zelensky or Chalupa or things that happened 7 years ago. He was interested in the Bidens.
Yes, sir.
Now, I think you also testified that Ambassador Sondland told you that President Trump wanted Zelensky in a public box. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And by public box, did that mean that private statements, private promises to do this investigation of 2016 or the Bidens were not enough? He had to go on TV. He had to go public in some way because the president wanted him in that box. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know exactly what he had in mind, and I'm not sure what Ambassador Sondland had in mind, who was the one who mentioned that to me. That's the implication. The implication was it needed to be public as opposed to being a private assurance.
And I think you said in that same call, you asked Ambassador Sondland to push back on President Trump's demand. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
So you understood from your conversation with Sondland, this was the president's demand, not Sondland's demand, the president's demand, and you wanted Sondland to push back. Am I right?
What I wanted to, so Ambassador Sondland was clearly able to have conversations with the president, and I thought that the pressure on another president, on President Zelensky, was not a good idea from either president's standpoint. So I suggested in that phone call to with Ambassador Sondland that he, since he regularly or frequently had conversation with the president, could make that point.
Well, and I think the way you express yourself is you wanted Sondland to push back on President Trump's demand, right?
Yes, sir.
So as your understanding from talking to Sondland, this is what the president wanted him to do, and you wanted Sondland to push back?
I asked Ambassador Sondland to push back. That's correct.
And in fact, even after the aid was ultimately released, even after the White House learns of the whistleblower complaint and the congressional investigation, the aid is released, even after those events, you were still worried that Zelensky was going to feel it necessary to go on CNN and announce these investigations, were you not?
Mr. Chairman, I was still worried that he might do that. So, yes, I thought that would be a bad idea. And so when there was some indication that there might still be a plan for the CNN interview in New York, which was upcoming, at the United Nations General Assembly meeting, I was worried. I wanted to be sure that that didn't happen, so I addressed it with the Zelensky staff.
And I think you said earlier that Dan Liuk, the national security advisor then for Zelensky, was concerned Zelensky didn't want to be used as some tool in American politics. Is that right?
That's correct, sir. So
Zelensky didn't want to go on TV and announce political investigations that he thought would mire him in U.S. politics, right?
He knew that he and his advisors knew that it's a bad idea to interject, to interfere in other nations' elections. Yes, sir.
But nonetheless, it appeared until the aid was lifted, the hold was lifted, that he felt compelled to do it.
He was making plans. His staff was making plans to have him make some kind of announcement, I don't know what it would have been, on CNN in public.
Even though he didn't want to be marred in U.S. politics?
Even though he knew it was a bad idea to interfere in other people's elections.
With that, I yield to Mr. Jordan.
Thank the gentleman for yielding. Ambassador Taylor, thank you for being here. AIDS held up on July 18th, is that right?
That's when I first heard about it, Mr.
And then it's released, Ambassador Taylor, on September 11th. And we know that from your deposition, in those 55 days that aid is delayed, you met with President Zelensky three times. The first one was July 26th, the day after the famous call now between President Trump and President Zelensky. President Zelensky meets with you, Ambassador Volker, and Ambassador Sondland. And again, according to your deposition, your testimony, there was no linkage of security assistance dollars to investigating Burisma or the Bidens. Second meeting is August 27th. Again, in this 55-day time frame, second meeting is August 27th. President Zelensky meets with you and Ambassador Bolton and others. And again, there's no linkage of dollars, security assistance dollars, to an investigation of the Bidens. And then, of course, the third meeting is September 5th. President Zelensky meets with you and Senators Johnson and Murphy. And once again, there is no linkage of security assistance dollars to an investigation of Burisma or the Bidens. Three meetings with the president of Ukraine, the new president, and no linkage. That's accurate?
Ms. Jordan, it's certainly accurate on the first two meetings, because to my knowledge, the Ukrainians were not aware of the hold on assistance until the 29th of August.
So the Politico article.
The third meeting that you mentioned with the senators, Senator yep. Murphy and Senator Johnson, there was discussion of the security assistance, but
no linkage.
But there was not discussion of linkage.
Three meetings, face-to-face, with President Zelensky, no linkage. Yet, in your deposition, you said this, and you said it again the first hour of the majority. My clear understanding was security assistance money would not come until President Zelensky committed to pursue the investigation. My clear understanding was they weren't going to get the money until President Zelensky committed to pursue the investigations. Now, with all due respect, Ambassador, your clear understanding was obviously wrong, because it didn't happen. President Zelensky didn't announce he was going to investigate Burisma or the Bidens. He didn't do a press conference and say, I'm going to investigate the Bidens, we're going to investigate Burisma. He didn't tweet about it, and you just told the ranking member he didn't do the CNN interview and announce he's going to investigate Burisma or the Bidens. So three face-to-face meetings, it doesn't come up, no linkage whatsoever. President Zelensky doesn't announce it before the aid is released on the 11th. And yet you said you have a clear understanding that those two things were going to happen. The money was going to get released, but not until there was an investigation. And that, in fact, didn't happen. So what I'm wondering is, where did you get this clear understanding?
as I testified, Ms. Jordan, this came from Ambassador Sondland.
Well, can you hold 1 second, Ambassador? I'm going to bring you a piece of paper from Ambassador Sondland's statement.
Very good.
And you can take a look at this. Go ahead, though. I want to let you finish.
So, Ms. Jordan, should I read this or?
No, I just want you to have it because I'm going to read it.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, but I want you to go ahead and finish. You said, Ambassador, you got this from Ambassador Sondland.
That is correct. Ambassador Sondland also said that he talked to President Zelensky and Mr. Yermak and had told them that although this was not a quid pro quo, if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. That was one point. It was also the case.
Mr. Morrison talked to you, right?
No. What I was going to say is Ambassador Sondland also told me that he recognized that it was a mistake to have told the Ukrainians that only the meeting with the president in the Oval Office was held up on the in order to get these investigations. No, it was not just the meeting. It was also the security system. That is, everything was. So those two discussions.
No, I understand.
Okay.
All right. So, again, just to recap, you had three meetings with President Zelensky. No linkage in those three meetings came up. Ambassador Zelensky didn't announce that he was going to do any investigation of the Bidens or Burismas before the aid was released. He didn't do a tweet, didn't do anything on CNN, didn't do any of that. President Zelensky, excuse me.
Right.
And then what you have in front of you is an addendum that Mr. Sondland made to his testimony that we got a couple weeks ago. It says, Declaration of Ambassador Gordon Sondland. I, Gordon Sondland, do hereby swear and affirm as follows. I want you to look at point number two, bullet point number two, second sentence. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yermak on September 1st, 2019, in connection with Vice President Pence's visit to Warsaw and a meeting with President Zelensky. Now, this is his clarification. Let me read it one more time. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yermak on September 1st, 2019, in connection with Vice President Pence's visit to Warsaw and a meeting with President Zelensky. We got six people having four conversations in one sentence, and you just told me this is where you got your clear understanding. Which, I mean, even though you had three opportunities with President Zelensky for him to tell you, you know what, we're going to do these investigations to get the aid. Didn't tell you three different times. Never makes an announcement, never tweets about it, never does a CNN interview. Ambassador, you weren't on the call, were you? The president, you didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Zelensky's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had three meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And two of those they had never heard about, as far as I know.
And President
there was no reason for it.
President
to come
Zelensky
up.
Never made an announcement. This is what I can't believe. And you're their star witness. You're their first witness.
Mr.
You're
Jordan.
The guy. You're the guy based on this, based on, I mean, I've seen church prayer chains that are easier to understand than this. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told, now again, this is, I hereby swear and affirm from Gordon Sondland. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yermak on September 1st, 20. This all happens, by the way, in Warsaw, where Vice President Pence meets with President Zelensky. And guess what?
Taylor,
they didn't talk about any linkage either.
Time of the gentleman's expired. Ambassador Taylor, would you like to respond?
The only response, I have two responses, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Mr. Jordan, glad to take those questions. Let me just say that I don't consider myself a star witness for anything.
They do. You don't.
No,
they
I
do.
Don't. I'm responding to your questions.
Please don't interrupt the witness.
As I think I was clear about, I'm not here to take one side or the other or to advocate any particular outcome. So let me just restate that. Second thing is that my understanding is only coming from people that I talk to.
We got that.
I think this clarification from Ambassador Sondland was because he said he didn't remember this in his first deposition. So he wanted to kind of clarify. But I think, Mr. Jordan, the way I read this, he remembers it the same way I do.
Yeah, and it's real clear, right?
It's very clear to
me. Thank you. Thank you, Ambassador Taylor. Mr. Himes, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
So let me ask you to just take a minute and just characterize for us what a real initiative, what a real program of anti-corruption might look like.
If we're doing a systemic, holistic program, you need institutions with integrity. That starts with investigators. It goes to prosecutors. It goes to courts. And eventually, it goes to the correction system. In countries like Ukraine, we generally start with law enforcement. And that's what we did in 2014-15 with the new patrol police. There also is oftentimes needed a specialized anti-corruption agency. In Ukraine, that was called the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, or NABU. There was a different body that reviewed asset declarations for unusual wealth called National Anti-Corruption Prevention Council. And eventually we got to helping them establish a special anti-corruption prosecutor and eventually a high court on anti-corruption. And that was to try to create investigators, prosecutors, and courts with integrity that couldn't be bought and would be focused on high-level corruption.
So what I'm hearing there, Mr. Kent, is a very comprehensive effort. So let me read you President Trump's own words to the Ukrainian president in the July 25th phone call. And I quote, "There's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that, so whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me." Mr. Kent, when you hear those words, do you hear the president participating in or requesting a thoughtful and well-calibrated anti-corruption program?
I do not.
And Mr. Kent and Mr. Taylor, the defenders of the president's behavior have made a big deal out of the fact that Vice President Biden encouraged the Ukrainians to remove a corrupt former Ukrainian prosecutor, 2016, Mr. Shokin. And in fact, Senator Rand Paul on Sunday said, and I quote him, "They're impeaching the President Trump for exactly the same thing that Joe Biden did." Is that correct? Is what the president did in his phone call and what Joe Biden did in terms of Mr. Shokin, are those exactly the same things? And if not, how are they different?
I do not think they are the same things. What former Vice President Biden requested of former President of Ukraine Poroshenko was the removal of a corrupt prosecutor general, Viktor Shokin, who had undermined a program of assistance that we had spent, again, U.S. taxpayer money, to try to build an independent investigator unit to go after corrupt prosecutors. And there was a case called the Diamond Prosecutor case in which Shokin destroyed the entire ecosystem that we were trying to help create. The investigators, the judges who issued the warrants, the law enforcement that had warrants to do the wiretapping, everybody to protect his former driver who he'd made a prosecutor. That's what Joe Biden was asking, remove the corrupt prosecutor.
So Joe Biden was participating in an open effort, established whole of government effort to address corruption in Ukraine.
That is correct.
Great. So, Mr. Kent, as you look at this whole mess, Rudy Giuliani, President Trump, in your opinion, was this a comprehensive and whole of government effort to end corruption in Ukraine?
Referring to the requests in July?
Exactly.
I would not say so. No, sir.
Yeah, I don't. I don't think President Trump was trying to end corruption in Ukraine. I think he was trying to aim corruption in Ukraine at Vice President Biden and at the 2020 election. And I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield my time to the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Ratcliffe.
Thank you. I thank the gentleman, and I thank you both for being here. It's obvious from your testimony today that you both care a great deal about U.S.-Ukraine relations. It's also very clear that you're optimistic about President Zelensky. Ambassador Taylor, you related one of his first acts in office was to remove immunity from deputies, which had long been a source of corruption. I know you had a number of personal dealings with him. Has he given you any reason to question his honesty or his integrity?
No, sir.
On October 10th, President Zelensky held a press marathon with over 300 reporters, where he said repeatedly and consistently over hours and hours that he was not aware of a military hold during the July 25th call. In fact, in his official press release from the Ukrainian government available on his website that I'll be introducing into the record, he said, "Our phone conversation bears no relations to arms. They blocked the provision of military assistance prior to our telephone conversation, but the issue had not been discussed during our conversation. I mean, I didn't even know." Ambassador Taylor, do you have any evidence to assert that President Zelensky was lying to the world press when he said those things? Yes or no?
Mr. Ratcliffe,
If I can respond.
My time is short.
Your time
is short.
Yes or no? That's right. I have no reason to doubt what the president said in his...
Okay. Very good.
Chair recognizes Representative Sewell.
I yield a few minutes to my esteemed chairman.
Thank you. Ambassador Taylor, I don't know if you've had a chance to read that some of the transcripts have been released. Are you aware that other witnesses have testified that Ukraine, in fact, found out the aid was being withheld before it became public knowledge?
Mr. Chairman, I've read that. I think there's still some question about when they may have heard.
And ultimately, they did find out when the political story came out, to your knowledge, but others have said even sooner. But they did find out, right, Ambassador?
They did, Mr. Chairman.
And at the time they found out, they knew what President Trump wanted from them, that he wanted these investigations, correct?
Ambassador Sondland informed President Zelensky's staff, that is, Mr. Yermak, of what was required, yes.
So Ukraine finds out about the hold. You're not able to give them a reason for the hold. No one is able to give them a reason for the hold. They know the president wants these investigations. And then they're told in Warsaw by Ambassador Sondland, essentially, you're not getting the aid unless you do these investigations, correct?
That's correct.
So, you know, you've been asked, how could there be conditioning if the Ukrainians didn't know? But Ukrainians were told by Ambassador Sondland, were they not?
They were. They were. They didn't know, as near as I can tell, the Ukrainians did not know about the hold on the phone call on July 25th. That's true. But they were told, as you said, Mr. Chairman, on the 1st of September.
And, in fact, while they may not have known during the time of the call, they would find out. And when they did find out, they would know what the president wanted, correct?
That's correct.
Representative Sewell.
So, Mr. Kent, I'd like to refer you to the discussion of the May 23rd meeting in the Oval Office, when the president met with those who had gone to the Ukraine for the inauguration. You briefly testified that you helped propose names for individuals to go to that inauguration. Was Ambassador Sondland, who was ambassador to the European Union, one of the names that you submitted?
No, it was not.
But he ultimately attended that inauguration. Is that not right?
That is correct.
And do you know how he ended up as a part of that official delegation?
I do not know for sure, but my understanding is once the list left the NSC staff, it went through a review through the part of the White House that determines presidential delegations.
You also testified that upon returning, Ambassador Sondland used his, quote, connections with Mulvaney, end quote, in order to secure this meeting in the Oval Office. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, yes.
It seems that this Oval Office meeting was a pivotal turning point in the Ukraine policy. Coming out of that meeting, who was given responsibility, to your recollection, who was given responsibility for the Ukraine policy?
I never saw any document that changed the nature of policy determination. In the U.S. government, under the Trump administration, there's the National Security Presidential Memorandum.
Didn't you also say,
please.
I have a little time, you did say in your testimony that you felt that that you testified that Secretary Perry, Ambassador Sondland, and Ambassador Volker, quote, felt that they had a mandate to take the lead, end quote, on Ukraine policy. Did you not?
That was an accurate statement. Their feeling doesn't mean that they actually got delegated responsibility.
Have you ever heard the term three amigos?
I referenced that after watching Gordon Sondland say that on Ukrainian TV on July 26th.
And what do you come to mean by three amigos?
My understanding of Ambassador Sondland's use of that term is that the three people that were in charge of Ukraine policy during the summer were he, Gordon Sondland, Ambassador Volker, and Secretary Perry.
What did you when did you come to learn about Mr. Giuliani's role, and what do you consider his role to have been?
I first heard about former Mayor Giuliani's interest in Ukraine in January of this year. That was a different phase than what happened during the summertime.
Was it normal to have a person who is a private citizen take an active role in foreign diplomacy?
I did not find his particular engagement normal, no.
Now, Mr. Ambassador Taylor, you testified that there are two channels, a regular and irregular. What did you see as Rudy Giuliani's role in Ukraine policy?
Congresswoman, I came to see that Mr. Giuliani had a large influence on the irregular channel.
And was that normal? Is that normal to have a private citizen of the United States take an active role in diplomacy?
It is not normal. It is not unusual to ask for people outside the government to give opinions to help form the policies of the U.S. government. It is unusual to have a person put input into the channel that goes contrary to U.S. policy.
Thank you. I yield back.
Thank you, Chairman. I yield to the chairman.
I thank the gentleman for yielding. I just want to follow up on some of the earlier questions about President Zelensky's statements after this scandal came to light, when he was asked, you know, were you pressured, how'd the phone call go, et cetera. Ukrainians, Mr. Kent, are pretty sophisticated about U.S. politics, are they not?
Perhaps.
You would agree that if President Zelensky contradicted President Trump and said, of course I felt pressured. They were holding up $400 million in military assistance. We have people dying every day. If he were to contradict President Trump directly, they would be sophisticated enough to know they may pay a very heavy price with this president, were they not?
That's a fair assessment.
And President Zelensky not only had to worry about retribution from Donald Trump should he contradict Donald Trump publicly, he also has to worry about how he's perceived domestically, doesn't he, Ambassador Taylor?
President Zelensky is very sensitive to the views of the Ukrainian people, who indeed are very attentive to Ukrainian-U.S. politics, yes.
And so if President Zelensky were to say, I had to capitulate and agree to these investigations, I was ready to go on CNN until the aid got restored, that would obviously be hurtful to him back home, would it not?
He cannot afford to be seen to be deferring to any foreign leader. He is very confident in his own abilities, and he knows that the Ukrainian people expect him to be clear and defend Ukrainian interests.
Mr. Carson.
Thank you, Chairman. My colleague touched briefly on the campaign to remove career diplomat Ambassador Yovanovitch. Mr. Kent, you stated in previous testimony that you were aware of the, quote, campaign of slander against the ambassador in real time, which basically unfolded in the media. Where do you understand this misinformation campaign was coming from, and who was essentially perpetuating it?
To my understanding, the then Prosecutor General of Ukraine, now ex, Yuri Lutsenko, met Rudy Giuliani in New York on a private visit in January. They had a second meeting in February, and through the good offices of the former mayor of New York, Yuri Lutsenko gave an interview to John Solomon, then of The Hill, in early March, and the campaign was launched on March 20th.
A corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor gave an interview to a reporter in the United States and made claims that the ambassador provided officials with a, quote, do not prosecute list. Sir, do you have any reason to believe this is true?
I have every reason to believe it is not true.
What was the reputation of the man who made these allegations, sir?
Yuri Lutsenko was a politician of long standing. He had been Minister of Interior after the Orange Revolution. The U.S. Embassy had good relations with him for years. He was imprisoned by President Yanukovych, came out, was elected majority leader of Poroshenko, the then president's party, and then became prosecutor general in the spring of 2016.
What was your experience with Ambassador Yovanovitch? Was she working hard to combat corruption in Ukraine, sir?
She was dedicated, as is every U.S. government official in Ukraine, to help Ukrainians overcome the legacy of corruption, which they actually have made a number of important steps since 2014.
So, in fact, before all of this happened, you and your superiors at the State Department asked the ambassador to extend her time in the Ukraine, correct, sir?
That is correct.
Did you support her extension?
I asked her to extend until the end of this year to get through the election cycle in Ukraine, and then Undersecretary Hale in March asked her to stay until 2020.
Now, some in Ukraine probably disliked her efforts to help Ukraine root out corruption. Is that correct?
As I mentioned in my testimony, you can't promote principled anti-corruption action without pissing off corrupt people.
Fair enough. Now, some of those people helped Giuliani smear her, did they not?
They did.
So ultimately, that smear campaign pushed President Trump to remove her, correct, sir?
I cannot judge that. What I can say is that Rudy Giuliani's smear campaign was ubiquitous in the spring of 2019 on Fox News and on the Internet and Twitter sphere.
So, Ambassador Taylor and Mr. Kent, in all of your combined decades at the State Department, have you ever before seen an instance where an ambassador was forced out by the president following a smear campaign of misinformation orchestrated by the president's allies?
I have not.
Nor I.
Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Dr. Wenstrom.
In your deposition, you spoke of support for Ukraine and its relationship to the United States and how much you support that. In 2014, you, and I'm quoting this, urged Obama administration to provide lethal defensive weapons in order to deter further Russian aggression. Did the Obama administration provide lethal weapons?
No, sir.
In your deposition, you said, and I quote, happy, you were happy with Trump administration's assistance. And it provided both lethal and financial aid, did it not?
It did, sir.
And you also stated that it was a substantial improvement. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
So now we're providing javelins, which kill Russian tanks. MREs and blankets do not do that. Today, you said, I was beginning to fear that the longstanding U.S. policy of strong support for Ukraine was shifting. I have a little trouble with longstanding based on what we just talked about, because it wasn't really longstanding strong support. It seems to me the strong support came with this administration. Would you agree with that, sir? Unless you consider MREs and blankets strong support, I wouldn't call it longstanding.
The longstanding that I'm referring to there, Dr. Winstrup, is the longstanding political support, economic support, and increasing.
Again, in your deposition, you urged the Obama administration officials to provide lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine in order to deter further Russian aggression. And now they have that under this administration, don't they, Mr. Ambassador?
They have the javelins, yes, sir.
Ms. Speer, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you both for your true heroic efforts, both today and also throughout your careers. I'd like to start with you, Mr. Kent. In your testimony, you said that you had, in mid-August, it became clear to me that Giuliani's efforts to gin up politically motivated investigations were now infecting U.S. engagement with Ukraine, leveraging President Zelensky's desire for a White House meeting. Mr. Kent, did you actually write a memo documenting your concerns that there was an effort underway to pressure Ukraine to open an investigation to benefit President Trump?
Yes, ma'am. I wrote a memo to the file on August 16th.
But we don't have access to that memo, do we?
I submitted it to the State Department subject to the September 27th subpoena.
And we have not received one piece of paper from the State Department relative to this investigation. So withholding military aid, does that weaken Ukraine?
Well, I think it sends the wrong signal, and it did for a short period of time. Again, the assistance from the FY19 was released and is in the process of heading towards Ukraine.
Does it embolden Russia when there was no aid being sent to Ukraine?
I think the signal that there is controversy and question about the U.S. support of Ukraine sends the signal to Vladimir Putin that he can leverage that as he seeks to negotiate with not only Ukraine but other countries.
Thank you. Ambassador Taylor, I think you mentioned that a White House meeting for Zelensky would boost his ability to negotiate for a peaceful settlement with Vladimir Putin and Russia in general. Is that true?
Ms. Spear, it is certainly true that that U.S. support for Mr. Zelensky, President Zelensky, in his negotiations with Russians is very important and will enable him to get a better agreement with that support from the United States, both from the military assistance, but also just from the political assistance that we can provide.
But he has not yet had that White House meeting, has he?
He has not.
Ambassador Taylor, is it true that the prosecutor general now has opened an investigation in Ukraine?
Ms. Spear, the new prosecutor general that President Zelensky has appointed is indeed investigating crimes in general. Is that your question?
Yes. But
yes,
he is in
office and is investigating criminal activity.
Has he specified what investigations he's undertaken?
No.
He has not.
Mr. Stewart.
Yeah. So in these corrupt nations, of which there are probably hundreds of corrupt individuals, hundreds of corrupt government officials, can you give me an example any time where the Vice President of the United States shows up and demands that a specific prosecutor be fired and gives them a six-hour time limit to do that? Are you aware of that ever happening any other place? I guess the answer is no. Are you surprised that there would be questions about corruption in Ukraine and that it would be discussed withholding some of this aid that's actually required by law that it be withheld if they can't certify that corruption has been eliminated or is being addressed?
The certification in that case is done by the Secretary of Defense upon advice of his staff in consultation with the interagency community. We were fully supportive of that conditionality, and the Secretary of Defense had already certified that that conditionality had been met.
And so we agree that we should withhold funds if there's questions about corruption that have not been addressed.
Mr. Quigley.
So that certification, that took place in May. Is that correct, Mr. Kent?
I do not believe it was certified by May. I would defer to my colleague, Gloria Cooper, who's testified on closed door.
But it was an earlier time.
It had not been done by May because when I was visiting in May, I was asked by Laura to raise a specific issue that would meet the conditionality.
But the DOD did say that they met the certification.
Yes, sir. I think it may have been in the July timeframe.
Thank you. So it's interesting and curious that we're talking about hearsay evidence. It is extraordinary to me that the committee's been able to get as much information as they had, direct or hearsay, given the obstruction. You gentlemen were both asked by the State Department not to appear for your depositions. Is that correct?
We both received, I believe, I received initially a letter directing me not to appear, and once the committee's issued a subpoena, I was under legal obligation to appear, and I am here today under subpoena.
Ambassador, were you also asked not to be part of the deposition?
Mr. Quigley, I was told by the State Department, don't appear under these circumstances. That was in the letter to me, and when I got the subpoena, exactly as Mr. Kent said, that was different circumstances and obeyed a legal subpoena. So that, yes, sir, I'm here for that reason.
Representative Stefanik, you're recognized.
And you testified that you first came to learn about Burisma in 2015 when you were the senior anti-corruption coordinator, correct?
Correct. Detailed to the embassy in Kyiv as the acting deputy chief of mission.
And you testified that the issue of corruption in Burisma was in the U.S. interest because, quote, and this is from your deposition, we had made a commitment to the Ukrainian government in 2014 to try to recover an estimated tens of billions of stolen dollars of stolen assets out of the country. Is that correct?
That is a stolen assets that were in the name of the owner of Burisma, Mykola Zlochevsky. He was the one who we believed had stolen the money.
Sure. So the first case... This was the first case that the U.S., the U.K., and Ukraine investigators worked on was against the owner of Burisma.
That's correct.
And this was during the Obama administration.
That's correct.
So for the millions of Americans viewing, the first investigation against the owner of Burisma was under President Obama's administration.
That's correct.
You testified also, quote, we spent roughly $500,000 of State Department money in support of the FBI and this investigation to build capacity and track down stolen assets, end quote. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was launched in May 2014 by the Attorney General of the U.S. and U.K. In conjunction with the World Bank.
Mr. Swalwell.
My question, Ambassador Taylor, the president conditioning security assistance on an investigation into his political opponent prior to this administration, is this something we would do all the time?
No, sir.
Why not?
We condition assistance on issues that will improve our foreign policy, serve our foreign policy, ensure that taxpayers' money is well spent. Those are and those conditions are either coming from the Congress or from policy decisions stemming from authority Congress has given us to make sure that the taxpayers' money is well spent or that the receiving country takes the actions in our national interest.
And you described in your text message exchanges that engaging in a scheme like this is, quote, crazy. Can we also agree that it's just wrong?
Yes.
Why is it wrong?
Again, our holding up of security assistance that would go to a country that is fighting aggression from Russia for no good policy reason, no good substantive reason, no good national security reason is wrong.
Mr. Mulvaney in the same news conference said, quote, if you read the news reports and you believe them, what McKinley said yesterday, well, McKinley said yesterday that he was really upset with the political influence and foreign policy. That was one of the reasons he was so upset about this. And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy. Ambassador Taylor, should we get over it?
If we're talking about political influence, meaning attempts to get information that is solely useful for political campaigns, if that's what he's talking about, we should not get used to that.
Finally, Mr. Mulvaney said, again, I was involved with the process by which the money was held up temporarily, okay? Three issues for that. The corruption of the country, whether or not the countries were participating in the support of Ukraine, and whether or not they were cooperating in an ongoing investigation with our Department of Justice. That's completely legitimate. Mr. Kent, were you aware of any formal Department of Justice cooperation request made to the Ukrainians?
I am not aware that there was any formal Department of Justice request in this matter, no.
Was Mr. Mulvaney's statement false?
I think you'd refer that question again to the Department of Justice, since I don't have full knowledge of whatever they may have been working on.
Just about an hour before the two of you sat down to testify today, the president tweeted multiple times about this hearing, and he put in all caps, never Trumpers. Mr. Kent, are you a never Trumper?
I am a career non-professional who serves whatever president is duly elected and carries out the foreign policies of that president in the United States, and I've done that for 27 years for three Republican presidents and two Democrat presidents.
Ambassador Taylor, are you a never-Trumper?
No, sir.
Mr. Hurd.
Thank you, Chairman. Gentlemen, I appreciate y'all's decade of service as the fabled Foreign Service officer, Ambassador Ryan Crocker says, because we have pumps and wingtips on the ground, meaning diplomats, that prevents us from having the need to have boots on the ground in the military. Y'all are an important role in our national security, and thank you and your colleagues. Mr. Taylor, my first questions are to you, and these are questions that are on years prior to your time in the Ukraine, but I'm pretty sure you can answer them. Did the Ukrainians get military get aid in FY17?
Did they get any aid in FY17?
Yeah.
Any? Yes, sir. They did get assistance.
And they got security assistance as well.
They did.
And if I said that number was circa, you know, in military assistance around $270 million, would that probably be accurate? Mr.
Close. Kent,
about right.
Yeah.
Did they get aid in FY18?
Yes, sir.
including security assistance.
Including security assistance.
We've already talked about the Javelins, the anti-tank missiles that they were not able to purchase in previous administrations. Have they gotten security assistance in FY19?
Yes, sir.
Prior to the $400 million or so that we're discussing or been discussing a lot here today?
They got some previous year, some probably FY18 assistance, but George, you may know.
It takes a while once money is obligated to actually reach the country. There were two island-class ships that just arrived in the port of Odessa, and that was with prior year money. So there's about a lag of a year.
My point is that we have been supporting the Ukrainians under this administration in order to help them kick out the Russians who invaded their country.
Yes, sir.
100%.
Ambassador Taylor, you earlier testified that Ukrainian officials did not become aware of potential U.S. assistance being withheld until August 29th. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding, Mr. Hurd.
Would you find it surprising if a Ukrainian official knew about that sooner and did not contact you?
I can answer that. It was only after August 29th, when the political article came out, that I got calls from several of the Ukrainian officials.
Good copy. Mr. Kent, had you had any Ukrainian official contacting you concerned about, when was the first time a Ukrainian official contacted you concerned about potential withholding of U.S. aid?
It was after the article in Politico came out in that first intense week of September.
Gotcha. So after that August 29th conversation. There's a lot of talk about Rudy Giuliani and who he was and wasn't meeting. Do we know or have an idea of the Ukrainian officials that he was meeting with over the last couple of years?
I don't, sir.
Have you had any Ukrainian officials call you after a meeting with Rudy Giuliani concerned about the nature or the context of that conversation?
Yes. Mr. Yermak has expressed concern about his interactions with Mr. Giuliani.
And I believe that meeting was somewhere in late August. Is that correct?
It was. There were meetings and there were, I think, also phone calls.
And y'all have talked many times that y'all are still concerned about corruption in Ukraine. Is that correct?
Sure.
Have we seen whatever this anti-corruption statement we wanted the Ukrainians to make?
Are you referring to the statement that was being negotiated between Kurt Volker, Gordon Sondland, and Andriy Yermak?
Yes.
That was not an anti-corruption statement, sir.
What was the statement?
I think if you go back to the back and forth of WhatsApps that were shared by Kurt Volker, they shared a draft with Rudy Giuliani, and Rudy Giuliani said it would not be acceptable if it didn't mention Biden Burisma in 2016.
But that statement was never agreed to or was never issued by the Ukrainian officials? Is that correct?
No statement of that sort was issued, correct.
Mr. Heck. And indeed, on October 15th, you testified about longstanding U.S. policy meant to combat corruption in the Ukraine, championed by people such as former Ambassador Maria Yovanovitch. But, Mr. Kent, is it not true that rather than fighting corruption in general in Ukraine, that what President Trump actually did was unceremoniously recall and remove Ambassador Yovanovitch from her post in Ukraine?
I would say, first of all, as I repeated before, the president has the right to recall ambassadors. It remains a matter of policy of the United States towards Ukraine to help them overcome a legacy of corruption and creating new institutions. And much of what we've been discussing today, which involved an irregular channel, was a request that went against U.S. policy that would have undermined the rule of law and our longstanding policy goals in Ukraine, as in other countries in the post-Soviet space.
Mr. Welch.
Now, you all have been very clear about what our continuous foreign policy was. And Ambassador Taylor, just very quickly, describe why us withholding aid interfered with achieving our national security goals.
Mr. Belch, one of our national security goals is to resolve conflicts in Europe. There is one major conflict in Europe. It's a fighting war. Our national security goals in support of Ukraine, in support of a broader strategic approach to Europe, is to facilitate that negotiation, is to try to support right. Ukraine when it negotiates with the Russians.
July 24th, Director Mueller testified about his investigation, and he established beyond doubt that it was the Russians who interfered in our election. And he expressed a fear that that would be the new normal. On July 25th, according to the readout of the president's campaign, he asked the Ukrainians to investigate Ukrainian interference in our election that had been repudiated. And then on July 26th, as I understand it, this person who reported to you heard the president saying he wanted investigations again in Ukraine. So this is the question. The new normal that Director Mueller feared, is there a new normal that you fear that a president, any president, can use congressionally approved foreign aid as a lever to get personal advantage in something that is in his interest but not the public interest?
That should not be the case, Mr. Welch.
Mr. Mueller, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for being here today. Lester Taylor, what year did you graduate from West Point?
1969, sir.
It was the height of the Vietnam War, wasn't it, sir?
The height was about that time.
What was your class rank at West Point?
I was number 5.
How many people were in your class?
800.
800 cadets, you were number 5?
Yes, sir.
So when you're top 1% of your class at West Point, you probably get your pick of assignments, but you picked the infantry.
I did, sir. Yes, sir.
You're a rifle company commander?
Sir.
Where'd you serve?
In Vietnam.
Did you see combat in Vietnam, sir?
I did.
Did you earn any commendations for that service?
I was awarded the Combat Infantryman's Badge, which is my highest, I'm proudest of. There was a Bronze Star. There was an Air Medal with V.
That's for valor, isn't it, sir?
It is.
Before I ask you about that, let's just talk about a couple days later, on July, 1 month later, on August 28th. You find yourself in Ukraine with the National Security Advisor, Mr. Bolton, right?
Yes, sir.
And you convey to him your concerns. You've testified to this previously about the withholding of military assistance. What does he say to you?
He says that he shares my concern, and he advises me to express that in a very special way to the Secretary of State.
Now, he's the National Security Advisor, works directly with the president, but he tells you that you should bring it up with the Secretary of State.
Yes, sir.
Have you ever sent a cable like that? How many times in your career, 40, 50 years, have you sent a cable directly to the Secretary of State?
Once.
This time?
Yes, sir.
In 50 years?
Rifle company commanders don't send cables, but yes, sir.
So the National Security Advisor, who could tell it to the president himself and who shares your concern, says you, the ambassador serving in Ukraine, should cable the Secretary of State directly, and you do so, don't you?
Yes, sir.
What'd the cable say, sir?
It's classified cable.
Without going into classified information.
Without going into classified, it says security assistance, it's what we've been talking about today. Security assistance to Ukraine at this particular time, as in previous time, is very important. Ukraine, I also make the point that we've also talked about here today, Ukraine is important for our national security, and we should support it.
So
not to provide that would be folly.
Did you get an answer to your cable?
Not directly. No, sir.
Do you know what happened to it?
Secretary Kent.
Secretary Kent, do you know what happened to it?
Tells me that.
Yeah, I was on vacation when his cable came in, but my understanding is it made it to its recipient, intended recipient, Secretary Pompeo.
And we know Secretary Pompeo was on the call a month earlier on July 25th. It's not like he's in the dark about any of this. What'd he do with it?
I honestly can't say for sure what happened with the cable once the message was brought in at the highest level.
One other question, gentlemen. On September 1st, you recall a meeting between the vice president and the president of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky, in which right off the bat, the president of Ukraine raises security assistance. And the vice president, according to your telling, says, I'll talk to the president tonight about that. I'll make a call. Do you know whether the vice president made that call?
I don't know, sir.
Do you know what, if anything, the vice president had to do with any of this? What more can you tell us about the vice president's role in this? Do you know if he ever raised this issue with anyone in the administration, whether he ever pushed for the release of that security assistance?
I can't, sir.
I believe to the best of my understanding, the vice president was an advocate for the release of the assistance.
Representative Demings.
Both of you have explained that you grew seriously concerned when you realized that the interests of this irregular channel diverged from official U.S. policy and interests. Was Mr. Giuliani promoting U.S. national interests or policy in Ukraine, Ambassador?
I don't think so, ma'am.
Mr. Kent?
No, he was not.
What interests do you believe he was promoting, Mr. Kent?
I believe he was looking to dig up political dirt against a potential rival in the next election cycle.
Ambassador Taylor, what interests do you believe he was promoting?
I agree with Mr. Kent.
The State Department's role is to promote U.S. policies overseas, not to help the current president win re-election. Is that correct, Mr. Kent?
All federal government employees are subject to the Hatch Act, and our actions are supposed to be promoting policy and not involved in partisan politics.
Ambassador Taylor?
I agree.
Ambassador Taylor, you have described in your previous testimony one instance shortly after you arrived in Ukraine in which Ambassador Sondland asked State Department officials not to listen to a July 28th call he had planned to hold with President Zelensky. Did you find that unusual?
I did.
What was the impact of Ambassador Sondland making that request? And you found it unusual. What do you believe the impact was?
Ms. Demings, I'm not sure there was an immediate impact.
Was there a recording or a transcription?
There was not. That was the impact. It was not recorded.
Do you think that's why the request was made, so there would not be normal State Department employees from the operations center would have been there transcribing and taking notes?
That is the norm, but it is also possible, it is not unusual to not have it recorded.
Mr. Krishnamurthy.
You stated that due to the hold that President Trump placed on aid to the Ukraine, the Ukrainians became quote unquote desperate. Isn't that right?
In August, they did not know, as far as I'm aware, but at the end of August, the article came out. In September, the Minister of Defense, for example, came to me, I would use the word desperate, to figure out why the assistance was being held. He thought that perhaps if he went to Washington to talk to you, to talk to the Secretary of Defense, to talk to the president, he would be able to find out and reassure, provide whatever answer was necessary to have that assistance released.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you have a second, please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast is produced by Jen Patia Howell. Music, if we had it, which we don't on bonus editions, would be performed by Sophia Yan. And our intrepid audio engineer and editor this week is Elena Kagan. A huge thank you to her and to you. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.